Thank you, and welcome to the Ninth Circuit. We will hear the cases in the order they appear on the calendar. We, as usual, will have petitioner or appellant reserve time, but we will not watch your time for you. And we will take a break after the second case, just for planning purposes. Thank you very much. You may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Sabrina Demast, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, Jorge Segovia. I respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, the petition for review should be granted in this matter, and the case remanded to the agency for two main reasons. First, substantial and probative evidence does not support the agency's determination that there was a reason to believe the petitioner had engaged in money laundering.
Well, is that an evidentiary problem, or is it a legal error in the sense that they misunderstood the statutes?
Your Honor, I think in this case it's both. The reason is that the BIA's decision references only 1956A2, which, as is conceded by the respondent in their brief, is an international money laundering statute that does not apply to this case. So first, I think as a legal error, the board has simply cited to an inapplicable statute to defend its decision on this ground.
But I thought it was also the case that there's a mismatch of the Texas statute and the federal statute.
Your Honor, that's correct. And that goes to 1956A1, which seemingly was relied upon by the IJ. And I say seemingly, Your Honors, because really, at the very beginning of the immigration judge's analysis on the money laundering, there's simply a statement that there is a reason to believe he engaged in money laundering and a string cite to cases mostly about the drug trafficking reason to believe, and then at the end of that, a reference to 1956A1. Now, it is the position of the respondent that 1956A1 applies to this case, and although it's our position that that is not the ground that the board relied on, and therefore this court should not be considering it, if the court disagrees, then I agree with you, Your Honor. There is, in fact, a mismatch between not only the Texas statute and the federal definition, but the factual findings made by the immigration judge would be insufficient to make a finding under 1956A1. The mismatch that Your Honor has referred to is the idea that the Texas statute that he pled guilty under criminalizes possession and mere transportation, things that are outside the federal definition. The evidentiary insufficiency here is because the respondent is asserting in their brief, Your Honor, that there isn't just a mere transportation at issue in this case, but rather a delivery. And they cite to U.S. versus Go for the proposition that a delivery does meet the standard under 1956A1. The problem, of course, Your Honor, is that there was no factual finding by the agency.
Can you stop 1 minute? The clock is not working. So I have no idea where you are in terms of the clock, so I'm going to assume that we're about 6 minutes in. Could you do that? All right, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. The delivery requires a delivery to a third person. And there is simply no factual finding by the immigration judge in this case, nor by the board, that the money that was in the car with the petitioner in either the arrest in Colorado or the arrest in Texas was being delivered to someone else. Their respondent suggests in their briefs that the court should find that it was bound for someone in the Reyes family or someone associated with Gold Star Roofing, but that's not a factual finding that was made by the judge or affirmed by the board, and I would respectfully submit it's not appropriate to make that factual finding in the first instance here.
Now, one question I have is, do we need, is this issue independently necessary to reach?
I believe it is, Your Honor, because the only ground on which the board affirmed the denial of the adjustment of status was the reason to believe money laundering.
I see. Because the IJ had another reason, but the board didn't approve it.
Correct, Your Honor. The board did not reach the issue of whether or not, as a matter of discretion or statutory eligibility, an alien smuggling waiver should be granted to the petitioner in this matter. Your Honor, there were two cases, one cited by the respondent in their brief and one relied on by the immigration judge to analogize as to why this should be considered a money laundering scenario, but both of them, I believe, are readily distinguishable. There's the Goh decision, which was referenced by the respondent in their brief. But as I mentioned, Goh involved an actual delivery. The individual paid a driver to take the money to a third party and then stood in an adjacent room to observe the delivery. There was clearly a destination third party to complete a delivery to. And as I mentioned earlier, there was simply no finding by the agency that this money was bound for any person at all other than the people who were in the car.
But so if we were to agree with you, we would presumably remand, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it is conceivable, maybe even probable, that they would find that this was likely to be a delivery, because otherwise what was going to happen to the money? It was just going to be put under the mattress. So there would be it wouldn't seem too difficult to infer that it was going to go to somebody, or that it was going to go to the bank, which would have been a transaction itself, I suppose. So likely it's going somewhere, and likely it will be so found, but there's been no founding at this point. Is that basically where we are?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. The agency made no finding, and it would need to be remanded to the immigration judge to address that fact. The other case, Your Honor, which was relied on by the immigration judge, Salazar, I think is also easily distinguishable. First of all, it's an unpublished decision, but secondly, Salazar himself pled guilty to the federal bulk smuggling statute, which requires a cross-border transaction, money either coming into the U.S. from abroad or leaving the U.S. to go abroad. And therefore, it fits neatly into 1956A2, the international money laundering statute. But all parties have agreed that 1956A2 doesn't apply to this case. Your Honors, moving to the evidentiary issues, with respect to the CCATS reports and the I-213 that were admitted by the immigration judge and used in her credibility analysis and in her reason to believe money laundering analysis. These documents contained multiple and clear factual errors. The I-213, I think, in particular, Your Honors, is really astounding. The respondent concedes in their brief that the entire narrative section about the immigration history doesn't actually pertain to the petitioner. It discusses a female Mexican national who had previously been excluded from the United States. And the petitioner in this matter is a male Salvadoran who had never been excluded from the United States. That the IJ still found that document to be admissible is contrary to both BIA precedent and virtually all federal court decisions. The presumptive reliability that attaches to an I-213 only attaches if there is no evidence of material of erroneous information contained in the document. And here we clearly have quite substantial erroneous information. Similarly, Your Honor, the CCATS reports.
Tell me something. Wait a minute. What difference does this make? Suppose we said, okay, the 213 shouldn't have been admitted, then what?
Well, Your Honor, it's one piece of evidence. So let me take a step back. If the court agrees with me that the evidentiary record as it stands, because there's no finding of delivery, doesn't meet the definition of, you know, doesn't have substantial and probative evidence for a reason to believe finding, then this is probably not an issue the court has to address. But if the court disagrees with me and thinks that the evidence as relied upon by the agency could substantiate that finding, then the admission of these documents becomes at issue. They're also at issue in the credibility determination for the petitioner. It's something like a Jenga game where you're pulling out one of the pieces that substantiates the agency's finding, Your Honors. And so if the document should have never been admitted, then relying on them for the credibility and the reason to believe determinations was error by the agency. Your Honor, the CCATS documents are similarly containing information we know is contradictory. They're in fact inherently internally contradictory. In one place, they say they never searched a conveyance. In another place, they say they searched the car. That seems very material, Your Honor, since the search of the car and the outcome of that search is the bulk of the narrative as to what took place during the Colorado arrest. which again forms a very significant part of the immigration judge's finding that there was a reason to believe the petitioner had engaged in money laundering. So to say that the error is minor is disingenuous, because it goes straight to the heart of why the documents were admitted by the immigration judge and what they were used for by the agency to begin with. Your Honors, if the court has no other questions for me at this moment, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for the rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Tim Ramitz on behalf of the United States Attorney General. Substantial evidence supports the agency's determination that the record provides reasons to believe the petitioner engaged in money laundering as defined by 18-1956-A1 and therefore is inadmissible and ineligible for adjustment of status. Between the Texas guilty plea the petitioner rendered,
I'm having trouble hearing you, sir. Could you get closer to the microphone or maybe speak more?
I'll speak a little. So I'm actually calling in through my phone. I was afraid that the video might drop. So
it's also quite choppy.
I think that's the telephone.
It's choppy, and some words come through and some words do not come through. So perhaps you could speak at about the rate that I'm speaking now, so that we can get everything that you want to say?
Let me try disconnecting my headphones.
That, in general, seems to be useful. We've had the same problem yesterday, and then somebody disconnected their headphones, and it was much better.
Is this better? Can the court hear me?
A lot better.
Much better.
Okay, thank you. Sorry for that burden.
Can I make one more suggestion? Can you put that on hands-free?
Sure. I hope we can hear the same.
All right. Well, go ahead. I'm just trying to protect you from having to stand there with the thing next to your ear.
Can you hear me the same?
Yes.
Am I still clear?
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry. I apologize. May it please the Court, Your Honor, Tim Ramitz on behalf of the United States Attorney General. Substantial evidence supports the agency's decision that petitioner is eligible for adjustment status because inadmissible for money laundering. And between the Texas guilty plea to money laundering, between the Texas investigative
But there is a mismatch in the statutes, is that right? Which was missed by the agency.
No,
because one requires there's just a difference between them in terms of the Texas statute covers more than the federal one does.
That's correct.
But the agency didn't realize that.
The agency does realize that. That's in the immigration judge's decision, and that is what petitioner argued for the immigration judge in his brief.
Pick up your phone again, sir.
Yeah, we're not hearing. Go back to the phone.
I missed that last part. Can you
please
say that
pick
last
up the
part
phone again?
Again?
You're going to have to pick up the telephone again. We're not hearing you.
Okay.
Okay.
I think it's best if I just talk to the phone. After the immigration judge's decision, where he's now analyzing the money laundering statute, that is the first part of his analysis, is he references the petitioner's argument about the overbreadth of the Texas statute. And because that was the petitioner's main argument, was that because the Texas statute is broader, includes mere possession and mere transportation, therefore it wasn't probative of money laundering. And you see the immigration respond with the court's precedent, saying that a reason to believe standard is not a categorical analysis. We're not comparing elements to elements. We are simply looking whether the reliable evidence in the record gives the reasonable observer a reason to believe someone, their behavior, engaged in something like money laundering. It's a lower standard than the categorical approach. And that's why you see the immigration judge reject that right off the bat, because it's not a categorical analysis.
I don't understand why that matters. So, he still had to make a finding as to the elements of the federal crime. Did he do that?
He just cites 1956A1. The immigration judge cites that.
Okay.
And then he notes that there's not a lot of precedent interpreting this money laundering statute. There's two unpublished decisions by the court, one of which was fairly identical to petitioner's facts. That was Salazar Gutierrez. And you see the immigration judge cite that case where there was hidden cash concealed in a secret compartment of the vehicle, And the court affirmed that that was providing reason to believe that the person engaged in money laundering. So that's with the immigration judge noting that this is not just a categorical case. The reason to believe standard is different than that. We're just looking at whether there is reason to believe your behavior meant that you might have been involved in money laundering. And I think this case, there's lots and lots of evidence indicating he was engaged in money laundering. And not only was there his guilty plea to money laundering, which is overbroad, but it's still the Texas statute, but it's still probative of the fact that he engaged in money laundering as defined by 1956A1.
Well, 1956A1 requires delivery, right? And the Texas statute doesn't. Is that basically the difference?
The Texas statute has that included in the statute, but also includes broader behavior like mere possession.
Or transportation,
so,
right?
Or transportation, correct. So it includes more behavior, but it definitely covers 1956A1. So it's possible by his conviction, categorically, that he was convicted of conduct under 1956A1. And it really is petitioner's burden to show he was not convicted of that behavior under 1956A1, because he is trying to prove he is clearly and beyond a doubt admissible to the United States. And he could not show that. He could show the statute overbroad, but when you get to his own testimony, you get to the investigative reports, they all show that he was, or gave an inference that he was delivering illicit proceeds to someone else. He was twice arrested when he left Los Angeles, and he went to different states, met with a member of the Reyes family, and then traveled back to Los Angeles with large amounts of cash concealed in a hidden apartment of his vehicle, which a canine search indicated the presence of narcotics. That is more than enough for an inference for the immigration judge to find that he was delivering illicit proceeds to another person. And his testimony corroborates most all of the investigative reports. He admits that he was arrested in Colorado with Maria Reyes, and that there was a hidden compartment in the vehicle, and that they found money wrapped in cellophane in the vehicle. He admits that subsequently, a year later, he was found doing the exact same thing with a different member of the Reyes family in Texas, where he's, again, police found he was traveling in a vehicle, and there was a hidden compartment in the vehicle. There was cellophane wrapped, vacuum-sealed money hidden in the vehicle. And as he admitted in his guilty plea, the money was part of drug trafficking. So, as an investigative report in Texas also states, that this was behavior, conduct that was consistent with someone who is narco-trafficking along the southern border. That is, people bring the drugs up from Mexico, and then people run the cash back to the cartel in Mexico. And I would say that this type of investigation does not give someone reason to believe someone's engaged in money laundering. I don't know what facts would be necessary. And as I already noted, Salazar Gutierrez had very similar facts, unpublished, so we don't know exactly what the facts were. But in that case, there was one arrest.
And it's unpublished, and it's not presidential, so please stop. This has become an epidemic, and we really don't need to listen to it. The epidemic of relying on unpublished opinions that are not presidential. So thank you. It's not just you.
Of course. And otherwise, petitioner turns to the reliability of the reports themselves, and the first problem with challenging the reliability of the reports is testimony already corroborated most everything that's important in those reports. Everything about his arrest. So a petitioner is now also stating that, well, there's nothing in the record that shows I transferred these illicit proceeds or an intent to transfer these proceeds. That wasn't what he was claiming before the immigration judge. He claimed the statute was overbroad. But he never claimed I wasn't transferring these proceeds. What he claimed was, for the Colorado arrest, one, that the cash was the result of car proceeds. And what he claimed for the Texas arrest was, two, I'm completely innocent. I had no knowledge of that money. And the Texas arrest is more easily put aside, or his claim about the Texas arrest more easily put aside, because he already pleaded guilty to money laundering in that case. He admitted before a Texas court of law that I knew those proceeds were part of drug trafficking. In terms of the Colorado arrest, where he claims that not that he wasn't transferring these proceeds, but simply that these were car sale proceeds he was transferring, immigration judge reasonably found that implausible because he couldn't explain why he would wrap car proceeds in cellophane and hide it in a hidden compartment. So he simply gave implausible explanations for his two arrests. He never claimed he wasn't transferring this money. He simply gave two explanations, which the immigration judge reasonably found implausible or contradicted in Texas case by his guilty plea. So his challenges of the reliability of the reports really don't even matter at the end of the day, because he already admitted into his own testimony to all of the criminal conduct alleged in those reports. And he doesn't, and so we have the adverse credibility determination.
To go back to the money laundering question, if we could, looking at the IJ opinion, it does not conclude that there was evidence that he was delivering or involved with a transaction. It says that the way it tries to resolve the problem is saying that the evidence in the record indicates that the respondent was arrested while transporting the proceeds of a criminal activity, an offense described under 1956A2, but that's not the right statute, and transporting isn't sufficient. Is that right?
Looking at the immigration decision or the board decision?
I'm looking at the board decision.
Yes, as the government's brief admitted, the board should not have cited 282.
Well, so therefore the board does not have any conclusion that actually deals with an element of the applicable federal statute.
Well, the board affirms the immigration judge's finding, and then it just simply adds at the end that we also would look to A2, we don't need to find translation. In any event, we don't need a financial transaction for A2. So that is really just an additional, conclusion by the board. So, as the government argued in their brief, we don't need that. The board should not have looked to that. But it did stick with the immigration judge's initial determination that it meets definition under A1. And again, as I was stating, Petitioner did not argue before the agency he did not transfer this money, had no intent to transfer this money. What he was arguing was that I was innocent in the Texas arrest. I didn't know about that money. And the Colorado arrest, I was transferring car proceeds. So that's why you don't see the Immigration Judge Board really discussing this, because he wasn't really disputing that he was transferring this money. He simply pointed to the overbreadth of the statute and then gave these two implausible explanations for why he was found transferring this money. One, I was innocent. I didn't know about the money in Texas, except he pleaded guilty to illicit proceeds and money laundering in Texas. And two, in Colorado, I was transferring car proceeds. So that didn't make any sense why you would wrap car proceeds in cellophane and hide it in a hidden compartment. So that's why you're not seeing this transfer addressing the decision, because that wasn't what he was claiming. He claimed he made a general overbreath argument, which is true. The statute includes more conduct than the federal statute. But he never claimed that his conduct, that's not what he did.
Thank you. Do you want to go on?
I will rest unless the court has more questions.
Well, thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Damest?
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to this issue of whether or not the petitioner did or did not challenge the issue of the delivery to a third party at the IJ level, I think that's not the dispositive question before the court. The question before the court is, did the agency make factual findings that each element of 1956A1 was violated, which, as Your Honor pointed out, needed to be done in order to find that he was inadmissible under the reason to believe money laundering statute.
Well, is that necessary, counsel, if the standard is not did he commit the crime, but do they have reasonable grounds to believe that he was drug trafficking? Isn't that a much easier standard to meet?
Your Honor, it is true that reason to believe is a lower standard than a conviction.
Right.
But it still is a reason to believe that each of the elements of money laundering have been met. And without a factual finding,
But they did make a factual finding that the record contains reasonable, substantial, and probative evidence that there is a reason to believe the respondent engaged in money laundering. That's a finding. Why isn't that sufficient?
Your Honor, I would submit that that's a legal conclusion, that there's substantial evidence in the record to support the finding. But what there's no factual basis for reaching that conclusion if the agency never addressed whether or not a delivery was intended to take place.
Or whether there was reasonable grounds to believe that a delivery was about to take place, not whether it was about to take place.
Correct, Your Honor. Whether there was reasonable belief that a delivery was to take place.
How about his travels back from Texas to California? Isn't that a reasonable belief that he's delivering?
Your Honor, two things I would say. First of all, I don't think traveling in a car, in fact, respondent concedes traveling in a car with money, transportation, is not enough, right? For all we know, and this is sort of the problem I think with speculating without findings by the agency, maybe he and Mr. Reyes intended to keep all the money that was in the car.
Not the money he says that he didn't know was there.
Correct, Your Honor. So maybe...
He says, how could he be knowledgeably transporting money, not for delivery, of money that he claims, I don't know it was there?
Your Honor. Come on. Your Honor, I understand that there was an adverse credibility determination, but even if you
But why was there an adverse credibility for? Because this was a completely bogus story.
Your Honor, even if we accept that the record indicates that he knew the money was there, and I concede that the plea itself relies upon him knowing the proceeds came from illicit activities, but possessing and transporting proceeds of illicit activities is not a form of money laundering under the federal statute. And so, again, I agree with the judge's assertion that this may all on remand come out not favorable to him. But there's still a reason that a record has to be developed at the agency level on this particular question. Whether it comes out favorably to him or not is something we can't judge at this moment because the record is incomplete on the question as to what the intention was to do with the money. Was it to keep it? Was it to deposit it in a bank? Was it to give it to somebody else in the Reyes family or Gold Star Roofing? This is simply just not addressed by the agency record and no factual findings made by the agency.
Okay, go ahead. You're just about out of time.
Oh, I was just going to say if the court has no further questions, then I'll rest.
All right.
All right, thank you very much. The case of Segovia versus Garland is submitted.